Welcome, everybody. This is Jason Tondra, and I am here for our fifth episode of our Starfinder Developer Diary on Fly Free or Die. And what we're doing here is we're just kind of going through the entire Starfinder adventure path, one volume at a time, with an extra volume for the pre-work and the post-work, just kind of talking about how the adventure path was created, what were the inspirations going into it, and how was it made? Like, you know, the nuts and bolts of like figuring out an outline and hiring a freelancer to write it and the milestone and turnover process. And like when I got to develop it, once the manuscript was given over to me, like what did I have to do and what worked and what did we, after it was all over, after I see the finished product, like, you know, what maybe didn't turn out as well as I would have liked and kind of how the adventure path might play, like some of the challenges of running it that we felt we noticed going in. And when I say we, I mean not the royal we, but the entire team. Creating an adventure path as a team process, right, that involves art directors and editorial staff, a team, help from my fellow developers, the creative director, everybody. So anyway, so that's kind of what we're doing here. And before we go any further, I want to thank the people that have been watching. Like, you guys have given some really great questions and feedback on this development diary thread. Some of you have reached out to me on Twitter. Some of you have written comments or questions on the videos. Some of you have noticed on Facebook. One of you even, like, you know, wrote to my boss, Eric Mona, and said, that guy's awesome. And I just want to let you know, like, that shit goes a long way with me. And it really helps a lot. Inferiority complex is real. I'm surrounded by brilliant people who are all, like, you know, incredibly talented and so fantastically good at their jobs. And it's really means a lot when you folks talk about how you're getting something out of this, and maybe you're about to run the campaign or you're in the middle of running it and this is helping you kind of navigate it, or you're learning new things about what got on the cutting room floor, or maybe you're learning like more about the development career, and how game design works. Thank you. I'm sincerely grateful to all of you that have written and put in comments about the show. Please keep doing that. You can reach out to me on, I'm mostly on Twitter, at Dr. Comics, all one word. I do monitor Facebook, but I don't really post there very much socially because Facebook is evil. Not that Twitter isn't much better, but anyway, another story. All right, we are here to talk about volume 4. In the six-volume adventure path, The White Glove Affair. Look at that cover. Isn't that great? All right. There's a lot going on with this volume, and we're going to have some really great and interesting lessons, I think, that we can get out of this as we talk about it. The White Glove Affair. So remember, let's go back to how we talked about the adventure path as a whole. And we talked about the outline and the narrative path, and you've all heard some of this a million times, right? But it's rags to riches, to ruin, to revenge. And this is always designed to be kind of a, you know, down to up, to down to back up again, kind of. And that's designed to give it some unexpected and interesting arc. But it's also an arc that I kind of frankly had to do because of the way that gear and money are built into leveling in Starfinder. I can't really run a game about poor working class heroes when you're seventh level or whatever, and you've got you've got a laser pistol worth 3,000 credits. Like, you don't feel poor. So I knew that by a certain stage of the campaign, it would have to change. And it wouldn't be about these kind of working class heroes anymore. Plus, the whole point for the characters in a lot of these adventures is to get rich. Well, let's let them get rich. Like, let's let you get rich. And then ask the great question about what happens then? What happens after you get rich? And this isn't me trying to say that money doesn't buy happiness, because we know that in some senses it does. But it also, there's a lot of great story that happens after you get rich. And in this case, you lose it all and then have to get revenge. But that's for future volumes. This volume, number 4, is the one where you get rich. And it's basically the con. Now, I knew that I wanted it to be a con, a heist, when I started to write this. It was going to be a heist. You're going to steal a starship. But as we started to brainstorm, we started, okay, well, what is that starship? What is it going to be? Well, those of you that remember from when we talked about volume one of the series, there is this casual mention in the Pat Worlds source book about these so-called golden treasure barges of the Callistocracy, the Prophecies of Callistrate, which are built at this special shipyard around Avalon, the Horseshoe Eye orbital plate. And you can thank Thurston Hillman, I believe, for all of this, because he wrote that section. And while we were brainstorming the outline, and I was in a room with Keely and Rob McCreary, our creative director at the time, and Rob was like, well, this golden, he literally had the book open and he was flipping through Pact Worlds looking for potential ships to steal. And he said, this golden treasure barge, it sounds kind of like the treasure fleet from the Caribbean, the famous Spanish treasure fleet that would sail back and forth from the Caribbean to Spain like twice a year. And because it's carrying ship, and it was many ships, this fleet would all be carrying gold and a pirate, sort of the holy grail of pirate plunder, right? You would rob the Spanish treasure fleet and make off with all of their gold, and it would be a fortune, right? And there's a lot of fiction and movies that have adapted this. Okay. Well, that's kind of how the whole Callistocracy thing came into the story. And at first, I was very skeptical of the Prophecies of Callistrate, of using the Callistocracy at all, because I didn't have a lot of knowledge about it. What I knew about it mostly came from one of the last Pathfinder first edition source books talked about the Callistocracy and its home nation. And I think Compton wrote it. And I have great confidence in Compton's ability. But the whole thing seemed kind of like ridiculous to me. Like this whole, it seemed kind of like, you have to remember, I grew up in Nevada, and L. Ron Hubbard, who founded Scientology, you know, lived like, you know, an hour's drive from my house. And I remember when he died, and the whole like sort of fake religion designed to bilk innocent rubes of their money. What is something I kind of grew up with. And to me, that's what the Callistocracy seemed like. It was just this sort of ridiculous fake religion designed as a way to, for the upper, the people who, it was a giant pyramid scheme for the people at the top of the pyramid to soak money out of the lower classes. So at first I was very reluctant because I just thought it was kind of dumb, frankly. And then, and I was kind of persuaded to use them reluctantly. And I had already said, okay, sure, we'll use the Callistocracy. And then I started to get more into it because I realized I'm writing an adventure path about working class heroes. And my bad guys, they worship money. I mean, they're like the perfect aristocratic, you know, like corporate evil. They're almost cartoonish in their capitalism, their worship of capitalistic greed. Now, a lot of the religious aspects of the Prophecy of Callistrate, like their emphasis on purity and the way that they wear their clothes and the way that they, you know, what they choose to eat and all that stuff, Compton helped me understand that the Callistocracy is not, as I thought, kind of based on Scientology and other fake religions, but rather based on faiths and other traditions in the history in anthropological history. And Compton's got a degree in anthropology, so that's why this all happens. You know, these are the sorts of trappings that this sort of faith that happens quite common in faith. So we define we define what's good, what's pure in terms of food and clothing and activities, and what are we allowed to do and what are we not allowed to do. And this creates purities and impurities. And then that whole business about basically worshiping wealth and deciding, well, I can take it with me, that I don't, that when I die, I can take all of my money with me and I will never actually be judged. If you remember how the Calistocracy works in Pathfinder, it's kind of this cosmic cheat code, because everybody in the Pathfinder universe, and of course Starfinder is set in the same universe, so it's the same multiverse setting. If you die, you go to Pharasma's court, and Pharasma judges you and decides where to send you based on your sins or your behavior, your alignment, right? Like, okay, well, you've been chaotic and evil, so off to the abyss you go. Well, the prophets, the members of the prophecy of the worshipers of the Calistocracy, I shouldn't say worshipers, they don't worship, they're philosophers, followers of the prophecies of Calistrate, they don't do that. Their whole point is to avoid ever being judged. Like, you're going to get all the money you can so that you can buy yourself some kind of eternal life, and you'll never actually go to Pharasma's court and you'll never be judged. So you are ultimately off the hook for all of your actions. You can do whatever you want in life. And then when you, but because you'll never actually be held accountable for any of them. Okay, that's perfect. I'm running an adventure path about consequences, about how the player characters make all these tough choices, and the choices that they make determine the consequences of their actions, and they have real ramifications on the people around them. Like, the player characters are living life, and the Calistocrats are trying to escape all those ramifications. They want to do whatever they want. They're totally self-centered, and they want to do whatever they want without consequence. I can work with that, right? Like, that fit, it fit into the themes of the adventure path in ways that when I began the adventure path, I didn't entirely understand. For other reasons, the Calistocracy became great villains, because they have a cool and identifiable look. The all-white suit that covers, like, the long opera gloves and the gold accoutrements is very distinguishable. Like, it's a brand. The Calistocrats have a brand. And I didn't pull out a lot of the art for you in this episode, but if you look through it, there are all these fantastic Calistocrats in this book, and they all have these glorious white and gold outfits. And it's just, it's fancy. It's really cool. It creates a great, unique feel for this adventure. And in many ways is a great contrast to that kind of overalls and greasy gloves that the rest of the adventure path really dwells on, right? Like, when the player characters arrive at the Calistocrat space station, which is floating in the middle of the drift, the sort of secret space station in the drift, they're going to feel really like fish out of water. Now, not like last adventure where they were groundwalkers underwater, and they were like, you know, so they had a real fish out of water experience. This is more like a cultural, sort of social fish out of water experience. Anyways, that's a lot of early stuff about the Calistocracy. The Calistocracy plot of ultimately climaxes next episode. When the players come face to face with Aline Misora, who is the Edge Corp executive vice president and also a member of the Calistocracy. But the Calistocracy culture and the whole sort of, you get really kind of immersed in the Calistocracy in this volume. This is the one to do that. And we have a great back matter article in this volume about the Calistocracy, complete with an archetype. So if you want to play a Calistocrat archetype, you can play one. And I was really glad to have that. Keely helped, was very amenable to my requests for that. And lots of cool Calistocracy gear that can show up in the adventure if you want to, and everything. While we're on the back matter, we'll talk about the other elements that are in here. We have three of the side jobs. We've talked about the side jobs before. They're basically like two-page spreads that give you a map and a stat block and the adventure's premise and kind of basic outline. And it's designed to be something that a GM can use to kind of extrapolate a whole night's adventure based off of the elements that we give you. And we've had a lot of success with these. I was glad to do them. When when we'll get to this again later on, but one of the challenges with the adventure path is coming up with a pawn set collection, which we build at the end of the adventure path after the whole thing is over. And when you do the adventure path, when you do the pawn set, you want to have pawns for all the monsters that are actually in the adventures. But you also want to think about the back matter, because if you don't do a pawn of a particular monster or in back matter articles, that pawn will never exist. I mean, if you like a monster, if you think a monster might be seen and reused later on in people's games, you kind of have to give them the pawn when you do the alien arc, when you do the adventure path pawn set, or it's never going to happen. Similarly with these side jobs, I wanted to do pawns for all the characters in these side jobs, but there just wasn't enough room in a pawn set. Pawn set's just not that big. And even though, Starfinder adventures are shorter than Pathfinder adventures, we still did not have as much room as I wanted, especially in adventure path like Life or Die, which has tons of characters. Like, there's just so many unique characters that recur throughout the adventure path, and not a lot of standard monsters. If you think about the kinds of enemies you fight in a campaign, often they're, you know, crazy aliens or monsters, and they're just kind of, maybe you're in Horizons of the Vast and you're fighting animals a lot. Well, this is not like that. Fight for Your Die has a lot of characters that you're fighting, a lot of like named NPCs with class graphs and stuff like that. And that meant a lot of different and unique stat blocks and a lot of unique characters, and they all needed pawns. This is a long way of saying, but there are exceptions. So for example, the side job has this new starfighter in it, a really cool, sleek, black stealth ship that looked very cool, and we were able to get it a pawn in the pawn collection. There's never room to give everything, so you kind of have to say, okay, well, I have a few spots left. What's the most important pawns I can give you? And the Shade Spiral in this case lucked out. While we talk about the Prophecies of Calistrate, and we have this whole article on the Prophecies of Calistrate in this book. We had some challenges with the Calistocracy in Starfinder. It gets like a paragraph in the core rulebook. But then in another Adventure Path volume, and I forget which one it is, I think it might be in the Signal of Screams, there's an article called Cults of the Galaxy. And in Cults of the Galaxy, there is a section on the Calistocracy, and one particular sort of subsect, there's a building and the guy who runs it, and that portrayal, he's a Calistocrat, he's a member of the Calistocracy, and that article really leans into that Calistocracy as Scientology pyramid scheme, that the whole faith is a scam designed to rob people of their money and filter it up to the Calistocrats at the top of the pyramid. And that's one of the reasons why I was very skeptical of the Calistocracy, because I thought, well, this is the Calistocracy in Starfinder, and it's not very, I don't like it. So we had to decide, okay, well, so, but when Rob read that article, he also was kind of surprised the Calistocracy was presented that way, because he did not, that was not his intention, and that was not how it's been presented in Pathfinder. It had been presented more straight, that as an actual serious belief system that people belong to and obey, rather than simply a con. And so when we commissioned the new article, we had to figure out, okay, how we wanted to do that, because we wanted to sort of set the record straight on the Calistocracy. And we retconned that article in Cult of the Galaxy so that instead of that being broadly true about the entire Calistocracy, which is the tone that the article is written in, instead it's just true of this particular like local regional branch of the Calistocracy, that this guy, which I think we even call like the High Prophet. Well, we decide, well, maybe he's not the High Prophet. He's just a High Prophet, right? Like, he's not the, because he's presented as being the leader of the entire philosophy. No, No, we don't want that. We'll let it. We can allow that debased, corrupt version of the prophecies of Calistrate to continue in its place, but we don't want to make it the galaxy-wide version, even though it slipped past us and got into print the first time. These things happen. Like, you know, sometimes when you've got a lot of people working on a team and there's a lot of material being produced every month, you don't always have, the creative director doesn't always have a chance to read everything, right? And sometimes you're just like, okay, well, I know you're going to do I know you're doing an essay on the cult of the galaxy. That sounds great. And that's all that he knew until it came out, right? And when it came out and he read it with hindsight, he was like, we shouldn't have done this. So then it's like, okay, well, now how can we course correct? And these things take time. And also opportunity. We had to have an opportunity to course correct. We couldn't just do an article on the prophecy of Calistrate and put it in any volume. It had to be, you know, in an adventure path that was using it and the volume that made sense for it. Okay. What else have we got? We've got the Midship Mimic. There's some great monsters in the back. There always are great creatures in the Alien Archive. A couple of them were made by Kendra Leispiedling, the author of the adventure. But we also have one of our many mimics. Mimics are a classic monster. Some people have done entire books full of nothing but monster mimics, space mimics. This one is a mimic that pretends to be a part of your starship. So like it takes over the dry engine or something like that. And it hides inside your starship. Mimics are so popular that I think we've actually put a hold on them. Like they're on our list of can't use for a while, various versions of the mimic. But this is not to say that the Midship Mimic is not great, because it is. I mean, look at that. It looks like Serenity's engine with teeth. The other, almost everything else in this, though, is part of the adventure. Like the planet in the Codex of Worlds is actually Fortune's Heart, the Calistocracy space station that you go to in the adventure. And two of the monsters in here, the Anasite and the security robot, are both part of the adventure as well. And so everything tied in very, very closely to the events of the adventure, which is good. But while we're on the back matter, let's talk about the starship, the Compant Windfall. This is the exterior, and this is the interior map. This is a great example of one of the problems with doing starships in Starfinder. We always used the interior back cover as the map of the starship. But the dimensions of this map are 8.5 by 11. And there's a very powerful urge on the part of map makers to use as much of that space as possible, with room left for a key here and your arrow, you know, your compass rose, right? And as a result, our starships all tend to be kind of wide and the same dimensions. Like, you don't see any long, narrow starships in Starfinder adventure paths, which is kind of a shame, right? I mean, like, we think of a lot of the great starships that have this kind of long, or think about when we design starships. Famous starships like the Enterprise, for example, or an Imperial Star Destroyer, or an Imperial Star Destroyer might actually work, right? Like, you can imagine that kind of wedge shape, filling a triangle on this ship. But even then, like, how many decks is an Imperial Star Destroyer? But we only have one 8.5 by 11 page for it. So we end up with all these ships that are all kind of like one deck wide and kind of vaguely oval in shape. And it's a little disappointing. And so if I, one of the things that I'm trying to do now is avoid ships that look like this. Try and make them three-dimensional somehow. Get like ship designs that have multiple decks, for example, or make them long and narrow, or make them round, or make them some other unusual shape other than something that would obviously fit on an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper. And we have had more success with this in later books. But this just is like a gingerbread man, and I kind of, and it's not the artist's fault. Like, I want to make it clear, like, you know, Kendra did exactly the ship that I needed her to make. But I personally, after we finished this and it was done, I really want to try and get better variation and more sleek, cool looking starships and less, you know, less kind of wide fat starships. All right. But that's neither here nor there. So so let's start with the adventure itself. The adventure can be very broadly broken down as essentially three steps. The first step is when the players think they're doing a heist. They're going to steal this starship. And it's all about sneaking onto the starship and hiding there. And then once it takes off with a kind of skeleton crew of like four other people, you can take the starship over and fly it wherever you want to go. And supposedly the starship is loaded. It's one of these golden treasure barges, golden commerce barge from the Calistocracy. But once you get onto the ship, you realize that your intelligence has misled you and that actually the ship is empty. There's nothing on it. But it's going to this place, this secret space station in the Drift, where the Calistocracy will auction it off. They will fill it with treasures. And then they will auction it off to the highest bidder, who will then take it out to the outer, out into the vast, and sell the commodities on it for more money than the galaxy can measure, right? So the players end up hiding on the starship for the first part of the adventure. And it's kind of this sort of, and that may sound really dull, but then you realize that it's actually, like, so then a bunch of challenges begin to happen to the ship. Like, well, you saw the cover, and that's a Shantak. And that's my fault because I told Kendra to include one. The starship starts getting attacked, and there's all kinds of other problems. And the players are faced with a choice: are they going to help defend the starship when the four crewmen, the sort of skeleton crew that are on board the ship, are grossly outpowered? So, like, they're not going to be able to take these creatures by themselves. Are you going to help, or are you going to let the Shantaks kill everyone? And those of you that have been watching the show, you know, yeah, that's exactly the kind of questions that I want this adventure path to be asking. The four NPC crewmen who are manning the ship are basically just working stiffs like you, right? They're not working for EdgeCorp. They're hired by the Calistocracy, but they're just, you know, they're just ordinary folks trying to do a job, and they don't know that you're smuggled away on their starship. They're just doing their thing. And are you going to kill them and take the ship? Are you going to let the Shantaks kill them? Or are you going to help? And if you choose to help, are you going to try and stay hidden? And so you help, like, by stealth but through subterfuge? Or are you going to come out of your hidey hole, help them, and then have to explain to them what you're doing here, right? And all of those choices and options become interesting. So that's the first part, is like sneaking onto the ship and the heist, the thing that you think is a heist. But then it turns from a heist adventure into a leverage episode. And if you don't follow John Rogers on Twitter, the writer, showrunner for Leverage, who has written products, he's a longtime role player, role-playing game fan, and writer, contributor to the hobby. He wrote for D&D, and he wrote a Leverage. Well, there's a Leverage RPG that's Cortex system, but I don't know if John contributed to that. Anyway, he's both a gamer and a Hollywood creator, and Leverage has long described it as five rogues, you know, having an adventure every week. Well, anyway, so Leverage is this wonderful television show, and it's actually getting a reunion coming back now. Getting the cast has all come back together, with one exception. Because no one wants to hire Timothy Hutton for good reason. But the cast is all back together with a couple of new people, and they're getting ready to do their operations again. Because if you remember Leverage, I know this sounds like a terrible digression, but bear with me. This is not as long as the Abyss digression from last week. Leverage is about poor people, ordinary people, working class people like you and me, who get taken advantage of by greedy, ruthless capitalists. And the heroes of the show, the team, the Leverage team, who are all these criminals, they help the people who've been taken advantage of get back what they've lost, and they get revenge, and they get even on the evil capitalist stooges. And there are a few things more satisfying than watching a bunch of corrupt capitalist CEOs get taken down Robin Hood style. So that also was a great influence on Fly Free or Die, and it fit again with the themes of the adventure and the adventure path very well. All right, so anyway. So in Leverage, in the middle of the episode, in the middle of this volume, in chapter 2 of 3, you arrive at Fortune's Heart, this fantastic golden space station in the middle of the Drift, where the Calistocracy, which the Calistocracy owns and which they operate, and it's sort of this incredibly high class. Oh, we have some art. It's this high-class, you know, like luxury spa resort, right? And but it's all filtered through the Calistocracy's versions of what's pure behavior. So everyone is dressed in their most exquisite, expensive fashions, but it's also all Calistocracy fashions. So you're all like completely clothed from your neck to your toes, and in white with gold trim everywhere. And they have these fantastic restaurants that you can all spend a fortune at and sip your champagne, except that there's no alcohol permitted in the Calistocracy. So it's all like non-alcoholic, non-fermented grape juice, right? So it's this really wonderful idea of like the super high deluxe resort station, but with the unique Calistocracy filter to it. And as soon as you arrive, and this was the challenge. So I gave Kendra the outline, and there were a lot of blank spots in this outline. That there was the outline was a couple of, you know, like maybe 3 pages. And there were a lot of blank spots where I was basically asking Kendra to solve my plot problems for me. And she did. She came up with some pitches, and she sent me a milestone, and we worked through all that stuff, and I was very happy with how it turned out. But I did not make her job easy. There were some fastballs in here, and there's two specifically, and one of them was this: like, okay, the players arrive on the station, they don't know much about anything, so we have to get them integrated into the story because they're going to lose track of the plot really fast. Like, okay, well, we're here, but now what do we do? And what I wanted them to do was to blend in. Now we're going to adopt identities as if we belong here, and we're going to pretend that we are a Calistocrat and their retinue. So one of the PCs will pretend to be a member of the Calistocracy, and they all bring, like, you know, their followers with them. And so the other PCs will be these followers, and you will then go about the station and participate in all these kind of social challenges and lots of role-playing opportunities. Not a lot of combat in this section of the adventure, some, but not a lot. And instead, you'll have all these opportunities for social and role-play stuff as you try to figure out, okay, how do we get the starship that's loaded up with all of these fantastic valuables? So the idea here is that every month, one of these golden commerce barges is set out from the Horse Eye over the plate. Well, it leaves empty, but then it arrives at Fortune's Heart. It's loaded up with star metals and other valuables, and then it's auctioned off. And whoever wins the auction gets the keys to the starship, and we give you the keys, and now you can take it to the Vast, and you can sell the contents of the starship for a vast fortune. So when the players arrive, the previous starship, the one that left a month ago, is loaded up and ready to go. And so the players arrive on ship A, but they steal ship B. Okay? This has left some people a little confused, because there's two of these ships in the adventure. The one the players arrive on and the one that they steal. Because the one that they arrive on is empty, but the one that they steal is full. It's the next one on the conveyor belt. Okay. So that was the first fastball. How do I get the players to do, how do I get them to do that without just telling them? You know, because we can have a long conversation about railroading versus sandboxing in adventure paths. I personally believe that railroading is a bit unfair of a term. Your players have signed on for an adventure path, and we, as the makers of the adventure path, you have come to us for a story, and you want us to do the prep for you. That's why you spent, you know, $30 or $25, however much this book cost you, and I have to look it up, $23. You spent $23 on this, and you want us to do the work, right? That's why we're here. You're paying my salary. And that means I'm going to give you a story, and I'm going to give you everything that happens in that story. And other people say, well, that's railroading. No, that's an adventure path, buddy. Look, that's how they work. And if I put pages in an adventure path that players don't use because the players went left when they could have gone right, we get critiqued that, well, I didn't pay $23 for a bunch of pages I didn't use. Like, I have to design an adventure that uses every single page of this book. And we talked about this in volume two, when we had a location where the players could go left or right. And I had to design an adventure that worked on whether the players went left or right. They're still in the adventure. They're still in the encounter. It's just that they're working for the rebellion or they're working for the empire. And either way, the encounter works, right? You can still use those pages. You can still use those stat blocks. Well, similarly here, getting the players to buy into this long con storyline is, like, pretty hard. How do we do that? Okay, so Kendra came up with this idea that, okay, basically, when you first leave the ship, you've arrived at the station, you know you're not supposed to be here, you don't look like you blend in, but as you're coming out, you meet a Calistocrat who also is doing something shady, and he just opens fire on you. And so you defend yourself against this guy, and in the process, you shoot him. And now that he's out, and you can say, well, it was self-defense, you can take his identity and his stuff, and you can take, and he's got an apartment, and you can just sort of take over his identity. Okay. That sounds great. And we wrote it that way. And I developed it that way. But when it hit editorial was like, wait a minute, what if the players don't kill him? I mean, they don't have to kill him. And what if they don't want to kill him? I mean, they don't know this person. He's a complete stranger. And he opens fire on you. Yes, he shoots first. But is that really a good reason to just waste him? I mean, isn't this an adventure path about moral choices? And I'm like, shit, you're right. So I think it was Ianara was the editor for this portion of the adventure path. And she was like, okay, look, I know that it's late. We don't have a lot of time. This conversation happened very late in the process. The book ships in a week. we don't have a lot of time, but here's an idea on how we can soften this. And well, what if you can like take him prisoner? And what if he just like offers you like, hey, whoa, I'll tell you what, like, here's the keys to my apartment. Just let me go. He can give you the stuff that you need for the rest of the adventure, and you cannot kill him. And it actually kind of works better that way. And I'm like, you're right. It really does. And so I want to like listen to your editors, listen to the entire team, because they will see weaknesses in the plot. And some of them you can't fix and some of them you can. So always try and take the opportunity to make those fixes when you can. The adventure's better for it. Now, I'm not going to say it's not still a weak section, because I think that it is. I got some pushback. Also, the guy that you impersonate, the guy that you meet at the very beginning, is this guy, the one that's on the cover. And of course, he's a Kasatha. How do you impersonate a Kasatha? Kasatha have four arms. Okay, look. Starfinder is filled with over 100 playable species. The chances of the player characters having in their group the same species as I need you to adopt on the station is very slim. I could even pick a popular species, you know, like Lashunta or a human. Well, maybe somebody, but then they have to have the right skill. Are they also the character that has bluff, that's trained in bluff? Are they the envoy or the operative? Chances are getting even more remote. No. I gave the character a holoskin. Holoskins allow you to impersonate any other species. You still need disguise, but you don't have a penalty for impersonating a number of a different species. And as long as people don't look too closely at you, you don't even have to roll disguise. Like you can walk around, and as long as you don't draw attention, your disguise is accepted. But I'm presuming that somebody in the group will have, you know, some kind of bluff skill, or, you know, be able to deception, you know, be able to fake it. So I figured that's the character who will get the holoskin, and that's the character who will pretend to be this Kasatha. But I got some pushback because people were like, a Kasatha? Really? They're like the least common core race, core species, which is true. They are. But they already all wear masks. Like, the Kasathas all wear masks all the time anyway. And so the fact that your voice doesn't sound right, or that they can't see your face, you know, they're a Kasatha. They're like that. And it seemed to me, in some ways, perfectly plausible. The alternative would have been, you know, a generic human trying to create an identity for that character which is as bland as possible, hoping that there's more chance player characters can impersonate that character. I figured once I had the holoskin, I could do whatever I want. Just don't touch them, because you probably only have two arms, right? So two of your arms work and the other two are holograms. But I thought, you know, that might have some interesting role-playing stuff, right? When you go to pick up a drink and, you know, your hand won't touch it, or you forget which hand is your holographic one. So anyway, the player characters impersonate. One of the player characters takes on the holoskin and adopts the identity of this guy, the guy that you see on the cover. And the other characters become his advisors and retinue, his bodyguards. And from there, you go off to that character's apartment. And once you get his social calendar and his schedule, you start getting into the character's flow. Like, this is the trick. Like, how do I give you the information? How do I give you the next step of the plot? So, and this is, and Kendra solved these problems. So this guy's got like a social calendar, and he has an appointment with a particular woman. And when you meet her, which is like immediately, like in an hour or tomorrow, like the next, the first thing you want to do is you meet this woman. And she believes you are who you are, because she's never actually met you in person. You've just corresponded by letter, by text, by video call, or whatever. She's never met you in person. So she believes you are who you are. And she now become, now we have an NPC who can kind of provide advice and guidance. Like, okay, well, you should do X, Y, and Z, right? And so now we have a voice who can kind of steer you. It's challenging to run. And I think that it works best if the players have a little buy-in. That the players are like, okay, yeah. But if you're running this part of the adventure, and what happens is the there's all these different sort of social scenes. Because your character, this guy, the guy that you're impersonating, he's here to bid on the starship. But he doesn't have enough money to actually win. So he's got a bunch of these like leads and people who owe him favors. And so the player characters now are like, okay, well, how can we get the starship? And the answer quickly becomes, you have to win the auction. You can't actually steal the ship. You have to win the auction. And how to play the auction was the other big fastball that I threw at Kendra. Like, okay, I want this to be a really intense kind of high energy scene that's not a combat scene. It's about bidding on this starship. And how do we make that fun and challenging and interesting when it's not just one player character like lifting a paddle, right? So the idea is you have to win the auction. Well, how do you do that when you don't have the money? Well, maybe you hack it, or maybe you find a way to get the money, or maybe you convince the other people who are bidding on it to not bid on it, right? So there's a bunch of different strategies you can do. And the adventure facilitates all these various strategies. And so be prepared in this part of the adventure for the players to go off way off script. Because in many ways, this is the most sandboxy part. Like, they spent like a week on the station. They have like a half a dozen of these social encounters at various points during that time. But it's also a big station and they can go wherever they want. So we try to give you a lot of NPCs and a lot of stuff to do. And there's restaurants and theaters and, you know, gambling. And oh, no, there's no gambling because gambling is against the rules for the Calistocracy. So no holo slots. But there's a bunch of stuff to do and people to meet and things to see while you are doing all these sort of role play social encounters. And the point of all of that is to win the auction. So you can save one person's life, for example. You save another bidder's life and she's like, okay, well, I won't bid on the ship this month, right? Or another, you find two rivals and you can decide like, well, maybe I'll help one against the other. And then you can, if you do it right, you can get them both to bow out, stuff like that. Like one bows out because they're too weak and the other bows out because they owe you one. Or you can have a duel of honor with some Callistocrat badass, right? And if you win, he was like, sure, I abandoned my presence at the auction, right? Or, in this sequence, in this whole part two sequence, there's a couple of interesting NPCs. There's a lot of interesting NPCs, but I want to talk about two in particular. So Kendra pitches me the outline. And she says, listen, I want to put in this subplot of a couple of these Versys spies who are here. And they've got, like, they're here pursuing, like, this knock list, like if you, the Mission Impossible, like list of all of these covert agents. And this list of covert agents that belong to this Versys intelligence agency has been stolen. And it's somewhere here on the ship. In fact, we think that it's in the ship that you are bidding on. And these Versys spies are trying to recover it. They don't have the money to win the auction, but they'll help you win the auction if you give them the chip. Now I got this, some of this I came from the whole idea of the auction. I was actually inspired by the James Bond film Casino Royale. And the whole, like, you play poker and then there's like a break when a fight scene inevitably happens. And when you go back to your room, there's a fight scene. And then you come back out and you play more poker. And then there's the CIA guy, I can't believe I've forgotten the CIA guy's name. it's going to come back to me as soon as I stop hitting record and I'm going to kick myself. But the CIA guy is like, you know, I don't have enough money to win, but I'll front you, I'll give you my money and you can come back. Right. So this is Kendra's riff on that idea. The idea that maybe there's somebody else at the auction who doesn't have enough money to win, but will help you win if you help them. My mind's still thinking about that, and you can tell I'm like, there's smoke coming out of my ear. Anyway, well, these characters, one of these two Versi spies was a former player character of Kendra's from one of her home Starfinder games. Okay, and you have all heard this warning, never do that. Never try to write your own character into an adventure. This is good advice for one simple reason. Nobody, and I mean nobody, thinks your character is as cool as you think they are, right? We all know the story. Do not tell people about your character. There's nothing more boring. It's a cliche of our hobby. It is maybe the biggest cliche. Like, what do you do to bore someone to tears? You tell them about your character. So the rule is never do this. Never put your own character in an adventure. That's a good rule. Always obey that rule. Except for the times when it's okay to break it. Kendra did not try to sneak this past me. She did not just present the adventure. And then after it's all done and all over, and she comes in on Twitter and says, oh, and that character is my PC from this person's game. Like, that would annoy the crap out of anyone. So, but she didn't do that. She told me it was her character. And then we examined if that even mattered. Like, the subplot worked. The big danger with inserting your character into a game is we have this tendency to make that character upstage the player characters. So you put your favorite PC in the game, and now that PC, that NPC starts doing everything better than the player characters do, and the player characters just start caring, just start being like aides and apprentices to the NPC who's God, Mary Sue, whatever. That wasn't the situation here. In fact, the NPC in this case only appears in a couple of scenes and doesn't really do much. They have some cool dialogue, and they have some interesting plot hooks, but their role in the story is to need help. Now, not a damsel in distress by any means, a Versi spy, but nonetheless, a character that needs the help of the player characters, that cannot succeed in their mission without the player characters' help. There's also this great frustrated romance story going on there. I am a sucker for a romance story. So if you ever want to pitch something like this to me, just make the character a potential romantic interest. And I'm like, okay, let's do it. Because in my opinion, there are not enough romance subplots in Adventure Paths. Anyway, so Felix Leitner. I knew it would come to me eventually. So these two Versi's characters are basically the Felix Leitner of this adventure path. And they're there to be like the CIA, who are rivals, and they're very cagey. They don't want to reveal who they are. You can figure out who they are if you do, you know, depending on what your characters do. You can earn their trust, or you can just figure it out on your own. And they're like, well, okay, so now you know who they are. So you're going to blow their cover? Are you going to work with them? Are you going to roll them over? Do you accept their help, but then not give them the chip? Because you can do that. You can accept the help of the Versi spies. You can win the auction with their help, and then not give them the thing that you bargained to give them. You can just sell it, right, and make more money. These are all choices. This adventure path is about these interesting choices, and this is absolutely one of those cases. If you give your word to somebody, do you come through on your word when there is absolutely no penalty for not doing that? No one's going to come after you. No one's going to shoot you down out of the sky with a space laser. There is no one going to give you a cookie. You are true to your word because you choose to be a person who is true to your word. or not. And I wanted that to be in the book. So there's lots of this, lots of like mingling with the white gloved aristocracy in the White Glove Affair. But ultimately, we turn to part three, which is the auction itself and the ramifications of the auction. If the beginning of this adventure is a heist, like the train job, and then the middle of the adventure is a long con, like the leverage episode, the adventure ends with the players winning or cheating to win the auction. They get the key to the starship, and then everything goes wrong. So you get the key. You're the only person that can open the starship. They've given you the key. And then your cover is blown. And you have to run for it. And everybody in the station is chasing you. So it becomes like the end of the Blues Brothers, where you're just trying to run through Fortune's Heart as fast as you can to make it to the ship so you can put the key in the engine and start it up and get it away. So there's a long extended multiple encounter action sequence as you run, fight your way out of the auction hall and back to the starship that you have won so that you can rocket away in it. A lot of challenges on this adventure. There's probably ways we could have done it better, but I think that it turned out okay. The parts that I needed to work. The auction mechanics, for example, are inspired. Kendra came up with this great idea. This is all her. I take no credit for this. Of creating roles that each of the player characters can fulfill. And there's a lot of roles so that we can accommodate a group of more than four players. So one person is the one doing the bidding, and they're making roles, right? Like perception roles or something like that to outbid their enemies. But everybody else also has a job. So like somebody is guarding the bidder and keeping other people away from them. And there's roles that you can do that. There's another person is like trying to hack the auction computer so that you can find out what people are bidding before they bid. Or another person is like sort of surveying the auction room and like eavesdropping on auction members. Somebody else is intimidating auction participants to get them to drop out, right? And there's a couple of other roles too. So the idea is that everybody kind of picks a role that they'll be good at, and you can change from round to round of the auction. There's a lot of things being auctioned off. The ship is the last thing. There's a bunch of other things being auctioned off, like cool treasure, basically. And you can decide, okay, you've got some money, and you're going to cheat in the final auction anyway. Like you've accumulated a bunch of money by this point, and you're going to cheat for the starship. So you don't need to use any money for that. So you can actually spend your money to try to win auctions for some of this cool treasure. And we got a whole sidebar full of cool treasure. And you, of course, GMs should add to that, like add all the stuff that you know your players want, right? And then they can bid on it. And everybody, all the players have a job in the auction. So everybody's doing something in the auction scene. Then after a bunch of the regular stuff is auctioned off, then there's a break. And of course, monsters attack, right? And then you fight off all the monsters. And then the second half of the auction, which is the auction for the starship, happens. Again, Casino Royale is your template here. Although other gambling, like I think the Maverick movie with Mel Gibson does the exact same thing. And then they win the auction. Hopefully you win the auction, grab the keys, and run for it, pursued by Bear. Now, the player characters have stolen the starship. Of course, there's a starship battle at the very end, right? Because you're pulling away from the station. Like the Calistocracy has a patrol ship, right? And you have to like escape it. Don't try to fight it because it's your ship is not designed to fight. It's got guns on it, but that ship's a gunship. You're here to get the hell out. You have stolen a starship that is supposed to make a Calistocracy rich beyond their wildest dreams. That's a lot more money than your characters are supposed to have at first, third, fifth, seventh, at eighth level, which is the level you should, ninth level, which is the level you should be at the end of this adventure. You have a vast, uncountable sum of wealth, like more money than I get, more wealth than I can imagine. Like that's the Blues Brothers climax to this episode. The player characters are rich. They are now rich. Well, okay. We can't let that last, right? Like, if the player characters are rich, then they will buy level 20 gear for themselves, and they'll be, and the rest of the adventure path will not be fun because they will be vastly overpowered. This is just part of how Starfinder works. In Starfinder, better gear costs money, and there's always better gear. So if you have a huge fortune, you can just spend it and buy incredibly overpowered everything, weapons, armor, for everyone. Spell gems, whatever you want, whatever your healing potions, whatever you want to buy. You can buy everything you want, and gear determines a lot in this game, like damage and armor class. And so I can't let you keep that money. And this brings us to the challenge of the next volume, which is called Crash and Burn, that Chris Wasko wrote for us. But you already know how this is going to go, right? Rags to riches. Well, not rags to riches. Here we are, volume four, riches. You are now filthy rich. To ruin, you have to lose everything. And this is volume four. So there's only two books left. So volume five is ruin, when you lose everything. And volume six is revenge. And we'll talk about the challenges of how to take away player character wealth, and maybe some good ways to do that and some not so good ways, when we get to next book. In the meantime, thanks to everybody for watching. Please keep in touch. We will be back next episode with Crash and Burn. And reach out to me if you would like. I would love to hear your thoughts, comments, or questions on The White Glove Affair or the entire Fly for Your Die or Starfinder in general. And I am at Dr. Comics, or you can put a comment or question below, and I will keep an eye out for you. Good night, everyone.